This is Macro Voices with hedge fund manager Eric Townsend, the free weekly financial podcast targeting professional finance, high net worth individuals, family offices, and other sophisticated investors. Macro Voices is all about the brightest minds in the world of finance and macroeconomics telling it like it is, bullish or bearish, no holds barred. Now, here are your hosts, Eric Townsend and Patrick Serezna.
Macro Voices, episode 232, was recorded on August 13th, 2020. I'm Eric Townsend. This episode is brought to you by TopTradersUnplugged.com, a podcast dedicated to quant and rules-based investing, helping investors overcome behavioral biases. StoneX global macro strategist Vincent Deloir joins me as this week's feature interview guest. Vincent says the 60-40 portfolio is headed for a nuclear winter. We'll also discuss inflation, social unrest, the European market outlook, and precious metals. Then be sure to stay tuned for our post-game segment after the feature interview. This week, Patrick has prepared a chart book all about how to use options to manage risk in precious metals markets.
And I'm Patrick Serezna. Now, Eric, let's jump to that S&P 500, which is toying with its retesting its February highs. What's your take on the S&P here?
Yeah, you know, I guess we've closed above the previous close, although I'm not sure if we're at a an intraday match to the previous intraday high. We're right teetering on it. And, you know, the way I see it, Patrick, why wouldn't it keep going? You know, people are saying, oh, well, what if it's a double top? Look at what's going on with the NASDAQ. Look at what's going on with the FANG stocks. They're already well into new all-time highs. So I don't see why the index wouldn't follow. I do think it's all being driven by central bank liquidity and by all of the accommodation that the government's providing. But, you know, I think they're going to continue providing it. And although there may be a little bit of a reprieve here in the COVID-19 crisis, I think this thing's going to last longer than most people think. I think it'll get better, but it's not going to completely go away, probably for a matter of years. And that means stimulus is going to keep on rolling in. So I don't see any reason that that won't continue to push the market higher.
All right, well, let's move on to the dollar index, because we put in a low in the early part, or at least a retest of that low in the early part of August. And since then, the dollar's just been more or less muddled, trading sideways. What's your take here on the dollar?
Well, at least the precipitous drop seems to have stopped, at least for now. The question on my mind is, okay, I wasn't really expecting this. Is this just a reaction to the amount of central bank accommodation, or are we really getting to that Luke Gromen moment that we've been fearing for years, where eventually the U.S. dollar really does lose its reserve currency status? A lot of people are talking about that, including mainstream people, where it used to be just a wild conspiracy theory. The thing is, I still don't see a replacement for the U.S. dollar. There's no fiat currency that would be suitable as a replacement for the U.S. dollar as the global reserve currency, and there's no digital currency yet that's up to that task. So I don't see it happening anytime soon.
All right, well, let's move on to crude oil, because it looks like crude oil keeps wanting to break out, and then every time it starts to gain some strength, it just pauses and then just backfills a little bit, and we stay in this tight range. When is oil ever going to make the big move here?
Well, it's not only that, Patrick. It's everything you said, but also when it finally does start to show signs of a breakdown to the downside, you know, it just barely starts to get going. It breaks away from those short-term moving averages, and before you know it, it's back up again. So we've been, I think it was about the 22nd of June was when we kind of broke the straight-up rally, and we've been consolidating sideways on price ever since then, almost 2 months now. You know, there's an old saying, Patrick, the longer the base, the higher in space. And the longer that a market gets coiled up like this, trading in a narrow range, when it finally does make a move in either direction, it usually tends to be a big move. I was originally thinking the next significant move was down, but I'm starting to think that we're just going to consolidate sideways until it's time for the market to eventually move back up. So the question you have to ask is, okay, what's the catalyst that would bring about a significant move to the upside? Going back to our discussion with Art Berman from a couple of months ago, the answer is when U.S. production starts to fall off a cliff the way Art predicted that it might start to in Q4. Now, U.S. production has been holding steady, nice and steady, for the last several weeks. We're down 300,000 barrels per day this week to 10.7 million barrels. Now, that's a significant one-week change considering how stable it's been. Is it the beginning of a new trend? We don't know yet. We'll have to find out. Meanwhile, inventory, crude oil drawing down 4.5 million barrels. The SPR also drawing down 2.2 million barrels, where it had been building as commercial storage had been added to the SPR in recent weeks. Cushing, Oklahoma, building 1.3 million barrels. Remember, it had been drawing down with a lot of that oil flowing out of Cushing, apparently making its way into the SPR. Looks like that's turned around in the other direction now. Gasoline drawing down 722,000 barrels. Distillates drawing down 2.3 million barrels. And again, U.S. production, 10.7, 300,000 barrel decrease. Let's watch that carefully in coming weeks, because if something is going to set this market off to the upside, it's going to be a steep decline in U.S. production. Art Berman thought that wasn't set to happen until Q4. Maybe it's here early, or maybe this was just a blip on the chart this week. Let's keep an eye on it next week.
All right, well, let's get to gold, because we were talking about it extensively last week and asking how long will that trend last, and it didn't take long to answer that question. So the bigger question is this the start of something much bigger, or is this a very quick buy on dip? What's your take on this whole gold move?
Well, Patrick, my biggest take on this is, thank heavens, finally, good news for gold bulls, which is, this is starting to look a little bit closer to a healthy bull market. As we discussed last week, you don't want to see those parabolic rises because they set up these big, ugly reversals like we just had. I do think it was a buy the dip moment. I did buy this dip, but I'm not convinced that it's over yet. What I would like to see, what would make me feel much more comfortable as a gold bull, would be if we got a retest all the way down to the breakout level, which was around 1800 on this move. So if we can come down and retest that 1800 resistance, test it as support, and then resume a nice, healthy bull rally from there, that really makes me feel confident in this market moving higher. I don't know. Maybe this is over already. That was it. Certainly what we've seen in recent months, this market's been so strong, it's crazy. Maybe it's all done. I'm hoping there's still a little bit more downside, so we clean up some of the choppy space on the volume profile chart and get looking a little bit more like a healthy bull market. But this pullback that we had was a healthy sign. It's much better than what we were seeing, and it gives me even more optimism for the long-term prospects for this market, which I couldn't be more bullish about long-term. Now, Patrick, let's come back to this subject in the post-game segment, because I want to talk about the conversation we started to have last week. We told our listeners, hey, we're going to come back next week. We're going to tell you how to use options to protect yourself in case there's a big pullback after this big parabolic move up. Well, it's a little bit late to have that conversation, but let's discuss what option strategies do fit and how that would have fit into the strategy.
All right, for sure. We'll circle back to that after Vincent's interview. So let's just wrap up by talking about this 10-year treasury yield, which with some inflation numbers coming out, seems to have had that pop in yields after sitting below 60 basis points for several weeks. We finally got a bump here in yields. We're now approaching spot 7-1 on the upside. Anything that you're looking at in that treasury bond market?
Now, the short-term signal, I really don't have any opinion. I look at it as we've sold off from over the last 35 years from, 15% 10-year yields all the way down to almost zero. We got below 50 basis points at one point. So I'm going to call it close enough to zero. Does that mean it's over and that we're seeing the beginning of a secular shift to a reversal and it's time for a bond bear market to begin? Or is this just a natural pause at a very important psychological level of zero before this market eventually marches on to negative interest rates? That's the big macro question. I think a whole lot rides on getting that question right. I don't have the answer. I'm going to keep asking our future interview guests.
This episode of Macro Voices was made possible by TopTradersUnplugged.com. In recent weeks, we've been reminded of the fragility of world financial markets and how quickly sentiment can shift from risk on to risk off. Once again, the mantra of buy the dip and the determination of central banks will be put to the test. But as Chris Cole recently told us, the best approach to investing in the long run is very different from what's worked best in recent decades. To help Macro Voices listeners navigate an uncertain future, Niels Kastrup Larsen, host of the Top Traders Unplugged podcast, has created a guide to the best investment books of all time. You can get a free copy at toptradersunplugged.com/macro guide. And be sure to listen to my full-length interview with Niels Kastrup Larsen on trend following. The download link is in your Research Roundup email. Check out toptradersunplugged.com today. You'll be glad you did.
Eric's interview with Vincent Deliard is coming up as Macro Voices continues right here at macrovoices.com.
And now with this week's special guest, here's hedge fund manager Eric Townsend.
Joining me now is Vincent Deluart, global macro strategist for StoneX. That's formerly known as INTL FC Stone. StoneX, I guess, is the new name of your firm. Vincent, it's great to have you on the program. Thanks for joining us.
Well, thanks for having me. I've been listening for many years to the podcast, and it truly is the best financial market podcast. I mean, you give a ton of content that used to be the privilege of a happy few, and you give it away to everyone, and you're doing a great public service mission here, and I'm glad to be here.
Listeners, Vincent has prepared a slide deck to accompany today's interview. You'll find the download link in your Research Roundup email. If you don't have a Research Roundup email, that means you're not registered yet at macrovoices.com. Just go to our homepage, macrovoices.com, look for the red button that says looking for the downloads right above Vincent's picture. Vincent, I want to give you credit as well because, well, we've had a lot of really smart guests talk about the shortcomings of the 60-40 portfolio design, which, of course, has been the gold standard of portfolio design for the last several decades. A lot of the smartest guys on the street have been talking about the reasons it's not likely to perform as well in the future as it has in the past. But you get the title for the best name, calling it the nuclear winter of the 60-40 portfolio. So what do you mean by that? Why is it a nuclear winter? And what are the implications? Because it's really what almost the entire industry recommends to most individual investors.
Well, thank you for the kind words. So if you start on the deck on page 4, you will kind of understand the term nuclear winter, because what the chart does is a long-term view of the nominal and real return over a 10-year trading period of a 60-40 portfolio. And what I find amazing about this chart is how steady it has been. I mean, if you have the time to wait for pretty much my entire life and probably several decades before that, you would be pretty certain that over 10 years, you would average real returns of about 8 to 9% with a 60-40 allocation. I mean, the only dip, and it was very brief, was after the 08 crisis, when briefly the 10-year trading return went negative before obviously becoming very positive as we had this massive rally in both long-term treasuries and equities. And if we look at where we are today, we are right, actually a little above average. For the past 10 years, a 60-40 portfolio has delivered real return of close to 10%, which is a bit higher than the average of 8%, in large part because inflation has been lower than what it has been. So the real return has been boosted by the lack of inflation. And I'm sure we'll get into this later in the conversation, that that's something that I expect will change. But I also expect that even the nominal return of a 60-40 portfolio, that trailing 10-year return of about 10% annually, is a complete misrepresentation of what's likely going to take place over the next 10 years. So that's why the term nuclear winter, which would include, in my view, a decade of negative real return for traditional asset allocation, something that really no one whose career started, in the past 50 years has experienced. Maybe that happened in the 70s, but outside of that, that's not something that any one of us has seen.
Now, what are the implications of that? If we say that, for the next decade, the 60-40 portfolio, you just don't think it's going to work. Presumably, for the first couple of years of losing money, everybody just says, oh, well, it's just a blip. It's these things happen. Just wait it out, buy and hold stocks for the long term. At what point does the world figure out that it's really not working? And what are the implications when they do figure it out in terms of people moving out of the asset classes that they've become accustomed to as just the standard for so many decades?
It will be a very messy process because, as you pointed out, the entire industry is designed for a world where, you know, bonds deliver about, you know, 4-5% return, equities, you know, around 10-11, and you take the average of that and they are negatively correlated and you get some diversification. Risk parity strategies rely on that. Pension funds rely on that. Individual investors rely on that. Robo-advisors build that into their own assumptions. So the entire world is really based on that framework. So as you take it off, the adjustment will be painful. I think that the quicker it happens, the better it will be. I mean, the way to restore the expected return of such a portfolio is to have lower starting price. I mean, over time, one of the biggest driver of your return is, you know, what was the valuation of an asset when you bought it? So we need these valuations to come down so that we can restore that portfolio. So the effect would be a massive repricing of financial assets, and it will be messy. I think you would probably see bubbles in other assets. I mean, I think gold is probably obviously a beneficiary of this nuclear winter of the 60-40 portfolio. And I think we're just at the beginning of that process. Maybe other things will benefit from it, whether it's Bitcoin or other more non-traditional assets. I mean, money needs to be invested somewhere. So as money leaves these strategies, others will benefit. And really only time will give us the answer. One thing that we know for sure, though, is that the people who rely on these return expectations, specifically, I'm thinking about pension funds in the US. I think on the latest survey of the American Association of Public Pension Funds, the median return assumption was 7.25% a year. That's what these guys expect to get. Well, you have 50 basis points on the 10-year yield. You have a PE of, you know, close to 30. So that converts to an earnings yield of, you know, around 4%, even with buybacks on top of that. Junk bond yields, you know, I would say around 5%, and investment grade yield close to nothing. So you take the average of these assets, and that's probably around 3-4%. And then pension funds tell you, well, by mixing all of that, I'm going to get to 7.25. I mean, this is not going to happen. Maybe some of them are going to be super smart and they're going to earn a trading return and they'll do the right thing at the right time. But collectively, the industry cannot earn the returns that it expects to earn.
Vincent, another theme that I've noticed with some of the smartest guests that we have on Macro Voices is a lot of people are saying, okay, look, we're either beginning now or we're going to begin a transition towards secular inflation in the next few years. And it seems like a whole lot of smart people are telling that basic high-level story, but each one of them has their own version of it. So moving on to slide 11, what's your take on why inflation may be on the horizon and what does it look like?
Well, I think inflation has been a question that most strategists and investment managers have preferred to avoid or not think about because it's uncomfortable. And it's also been a sure way to look like an idiot. People who worried about inflation after QE1, QE2, QE3 have all been proven wrong. So I think there's a lot of resistance now to make the inflation call. The burden of the proof is indeed on the inflation scam. But I think we have enough evidence that now is different. And in the presentation mentioned what I call the six horsemen of inflation, which are signs of inflation that you see across time and across countries that have always led to inflation. And I would say that all six horsemen are here in the US today. I'll briefly name them, then we can just, you know, jump into any of them. The first one is asset price bubbles, which by any definition, if you look at, you know, the forward P ratio of the Russell 2000 index at something like 100, if you look at the price to sell ratio of Microsoft at 11 or 12, the fact that Apple is, you know, has almost doubled in the past 6 months. I mean, you see these bubbles literally everywhere. Of course, these bubbles are not as impressive measured in terms of gold. I mean, you could already argue, by the way, that gold has outperformed equities for the past 5 years, which in a way can be seen as a definition of an inflationary bull market, a period where financial asset returns lag that of gold, which is an asset that produces nothing. So asset price bubble is the first one. The second one is the great central bank bubble. Of course, we've discussed that many times before. This explosion in liquidity, which has accelerated in the past 6 months. Eventually, if there's any truth to the MD equal PT equation, I mean, the increase in M has been so large that eventually you should see some impact on prices. The next one is protectionism and a what I would describe as a cost shock. I think when all is said and done, COVID will be seen for an increase in the cost of stuff, the same way that after 1973, you know, the price of oil increased, so the price of everything that used oil went up. While COVID, with all its restrictions on, you know, how people can work, how they can travel, will increase the cost of doing business in around the world. Then the fourth one is debt. We came into this with a huge corporate debt problem, a huge profitability problem in the United States. And on top of that, we've added now much more public debt. So we really have too much debt, and inflation has been historically a way to deal with debt in a politically not so painful way, which then brings me to the next horseman, which is manipulated prices. I mean, typically inflation does not last in free market economies because the price mechanism ensures that, you know, resources are allocated where they're needed, humans are smart and creative, and that tends to bring price down. However, when you have a system where prices are not only set by markets, but they are set by, you know, central banks or political committees, it's much harder to squeeze inflation out of the system. And that's experienced Soviet Union, Venezuela, and other countries that have tried these kind of state-oriented markets, which I think is where we're going in the U.S. And then the last one, which is probably the most important, I think, if we think about secular inflation, is generational divide. I think one of the biggest crises in the U.S. is wealth and income gap between the young and the old generation. And in a curious way, I think inflation is going to be the only feasible solution to bridge that gap.
And how do you see that gap being bridged by inflation? What are the policy changes that you expect that would bring about that change?
A lot of it would have to do with MMT or what I think Ray Dalio calls that monetary policy 3.0, maybe, where you see a transition from really QE for the rich. I mean, that's kind of what we had. We have 10 years of MMT behind us. It's just been spent for the benefit of asset owners. I mean, typically when the central bank uses the common resource, which is the currency issued by the government, and uses it to buy assets, well, it subsidizes the asset owners. So we had already, you know, since away really 10 years of MMT, we just gave it to whoever owns treasuries, mortgage-backed securities, now junk bond, corporate bonds, and so forth. And I think what we are witnessing progressively, but I think COVID has kind of accelerated that shift, is a transition towards fiscal policy, direct deficit monetization, and a MMT that actually, you know, is more about sending money to people, whether that's through unemployment benefit or eventually through UBI, or through just, you know, goodies, you know, could be like, you know, better healthcare, which the U.S. badly needs, could be the cancellation of student loan debts. So I think that is that transition that will prove inflationary and in a way solve some of these generational gaps.
Vincent, let's move on to the U.S. dollar. We've seen the dollar index test a low 92 handle intraday recently, and we're still just barely above 93. A lot of people thought, you know, it seemed like 96 was really good support, and all of a sudden the bottom fell out. Is this the beginning of the big move that Luke Groman and others have predicted, you know, the end of the dollar? Or is this more of just a cyclical move that's likely to eventually retrace to the upside?
My answer would be somewhere in the middle. I think it's certainly too early to proclaim the death of the U.S. dollar as a reserve currency, although that will probably happen someday. I mean, that has happened to hundreds of currencies before, but it's probably too early to call it that way. I also think I would not underestimate this as just a short-term cyclical move. I think we are entering a secular bear market for the dollar. Not necessarily one where the dollar loses its exorbitant privilege, but something more like what we experienced between 2002 to 2007, where, you know, the euro went from, you know, probably parity to close to 1.6 at the peak, and the dollar lost ground against, you know, major currencies, including the Brazilian real, which, you know, usually is not a currency that appreciates. So I think that's where we are. The dollar has gotten to be massively overvalued. International assets have been repressed compared to dollar assets. And there's a little bit of a self-fulfilling prophecy, right? Because as the dollar weakens, it makes it easier for emerging markets borrower to service their debt. It improves global growth. It improves their profits. It improves commodity prices. So this loop really is just starting between the weak dollar and the outperformance of international assets. And typically these things last for, you know, 5 to 7 years. Now, time will tell if this will lead into a complete demise of the dollar or if it's just one of these normal kind of healthy cycles of dollar weakness.
Vincent, I know that before moving to StoneX, you were with Ned Davis Research, where you created their European research product. Talk to us a little bit about how Europe fits into this big macro picture. We've clearly got, you know, the U.S. Markets are recovering, even if the U.S. Economy isn't. What's your outlook for Europe, both markets and the economy?
I would say, to some extent, cautiously optimistic. In the first phase of the pandemic, it looked like Europe was really going to be the biggest victim of it, and for good reason. I mean, we had the most deaths, we had the harshest lockdowns, and then we have an economy in Europe that is heavily dependent on tourism, on mobility. You know, you look at a European index, there's basically no tech. It's car manufacturers and service-related stuff that was going to be badly impacted by COVID. So for a bit, it looked like Europe was going to really suffer the brunt of this. And that lasted up until the U.S. really messed it up. And now, in comparison, you're like, well, Europe looks pretty good. You know, Germany, most of Northern and Eastern Europe, you know, did actually okay containing the pandemic. They are opening up. I mean, yeah, we're seeing a little spike of infections here and there. But, you know, I think that compared to where we are in the U.S., it's under control. So, you know, this is probably a good moment for Europe. There's certainly been this massive fiscal impulse, which Europe has been dying for 10 years from thriftiness and the North's refusal to engage in fiscal spending. And it's as if the COVID crisis has led to some sort of collectivization of pragmatism. Like, hey, this could take us all down. We are, you know, I don't think the Germans or the Dutch are doing this out of their hearts, but they realize that their economy requires Spain and Italy and Greece not to fall off the cliff. And that's where we're going to go. So I think in a way, the departure of England, Brexit, has helped that, because, you know, England has always been a Trojan horse. So now that England's gone, well, Germany doesn't have much of a choice. It has to turn back to France, and it has to do some of these kind of fiscal stimulus measure, more integration. I still think there are severe issues with the euro over the long term, but over the short term, it's cheap. The economy is somewhat recovering. We are seeing political momentum. So I would see an opportunity provided, and that's a big, big if, provided the virus doesn't get worse. I mean, if there is a vaccine, I think Europe is a fantastic value opportunity. If we have a second wave, I don't think the European economy can survive operating in a COVID world where people have to social distance and can't go on vacation, can't go on hotels and all that stuff. So to me, the vaccine covered that is in Europe, not in the U.S. You know, I know all the Robin Hood day traders, they try to buy airlines or cruise ships, whatever. You would do much better buying cyclical European stocks from much cheaper and much further along the way of the recovery.
Vincent, I want to come back to the subject of political unrest and this generational crisis that you alluded to a few minutes ago. You've got a series of slides talking about this starting on page 19 of your slide deck. This is a topic that is near and dear to my heart. I've spoken quite a bit about it on Macro Voices, but I want to get your take. How do you see this situation? Why do we have all of this political unrest? What's driving it? Is it the fourth turning that Neil Howe talks about or something else? What's driving it? Where is it headed? And how does it eventually get resolved?
Well, I think the biggest driver is really that first chart we see on page 19, which looks at the ratio of the S&P 500 index to the minimum wage. And basically what it tells you is how many hours you need to work at the minimum wage in order to buy one share of the index. In the 1970s, when the boomers were growing up, leaving their homes, starting their jobs, you know, starting households, that was about 2 weeks. Today, it's closer to 2 months, and a fourfold increase in this ratio. And the way I interpret this ratio is that it really measures the terms of the trade between generations. I mean, you can think of the young generation as a generation, for the most of us at least, who don't have trust funds, we need to offer work in order to buy assets. And typically, our work when we're young is not that qualified. It's closer to minimum wage and a career, right? So we earn the minimum wage and we try to build assets with that. Conversely, you can think of the old generation as a generation that whose human capital is mostly depleted, right? I mean, if you're past 65, you usually retire. So really your goal now is to convert the capital that you accumulated over your career into work that will be provided to you by other people. So the term of the trade has increased by fourfold in favor of the old generation. They can buy a lot more labor with their assets. And conversely, the young generation can buy a lot fewer assets with their labor than they used to. Not only that, but we also have what I call differentiated inflation problem. So the Bureau of Labor Statistics report only one inflation number, or at least we only care about one, the CPIU, which is the basket of urban whatever, a typical basket of an urban consumer. Now, in that basket, some of the very big weights are things like housing, about 20 to 30%, the owner's rent equivalent. Then the next best thing aggregated is healthcare expense, and then it's education. Well, if you think about where these expenses fall, they fall very differently across generation. For the old generation, they don't pay for housing. Most people own their home. If anything, they may even be able to rent it out, have an Airbnb people. So it's that the house price inflation for the old generation is actually positive for them. Conversely, of course, the young, typically a young household pays, you know, if you live in a major city, it's going to be 30 to 40% of your salary is going to be spent on rent. Same thing with healthcare. I mean, in the U.S., if you are past 65, it may go down to 60, you get, you know, Medicare, so you don't have to pay for it. So you're insured against the risk of healthcare inflation. Conversely, if you're young, typically you don't consume a lot of healthcare. I mean, I never see a doctor because I'm never sick. Yet my premium, my insurance premium goes up by 10% every year. So you keep paying more for something that you really don't consume. And then last, education. Well, obviously, if you're retired, you're not going to pay college debt. You're not going to pay to go to college. But if you're young, you need to build your skills. That's what we've been told by society. And that's what we've done. And if you have college debt, you really go to high interest. And as far as I'm aware, it's the only debt in the U.S. that you cannot default upon. So you have this unextinguishable debt, usually at a high interest, that an entire generation carries. So what I did in the chart on page 90, in the second chart, is I fixed the CPIU and I created a boomer consumer index, which is indeed deflationary, because what it captures is the fact that the cost of shopping at Walmart has gone down because of China. The cost of travel has gone down because of globalization. The cost of a European cruise vacation has gone down. The things that old people buy have gotten cheaper. And then I've built another index, which is much more heavily skewed towards housing, education, and healthcare, which is much more representative of what the young generation is spending, is experiencing, and that has increased by 5 to 10% every year for the past decade. So in a way, I would argue we already have inflation. It just only hit one group. One group has had inflation, another group has a deflation, and on average, we had like 1.5% inflation. But that average does not capture the reality of anybody. And what we need to do if we want to have proper economic growth, if we want to restore some semblance of cohesion in society, is we need to these trends to invert. We need the stuff that the young people pay for, the price need to go down, and conversely, maybe, you know, an increase in the cost of living for all people. That is the solution. And I think to some extent, broad inflation because of MMT, because of rising wages, and then falling asset prices will bring that outcome.
Vincent, let's come back to inflation and specifically why it hasn't happened. You've got a series of slides in the deck coming up that talks about that, starting on page 21.
Yes. So back in 2009, 2010, when we started this massive monetary expansion and QE programs, a lot of people were worried about inflation. Basically, with MV equals PD, we increase M, eventually P will increase. And that didn't happen. And I think the reason that didn't happen is because monetary policy was doing one thing, but fiscal policy was doing another thing. And especially in Europe, prudential policy was doing another thing. So the central bank was easing, but at the same time, we had massive fiscal tightening. I mean, in the U.S., I think in 2009, the budget deficit was close to 10% of GDP. By the end of the second Obama mandate, it was down to 2%. Europe, even more insane experiment with fiscal contraction, because we eventually went to a surplus, because, you know, Germany, the Netherlands, Austria, the virtuous countries actually had a budget surplus. So went from minus 10 to a surplus. So massive fiscal retrenchment at the time we had this monetary easing. And then also in Europe, which I think is the better case for the deflationary economy, we also had prudential regulation that forced the bank to deleverage. I mean, going in 2008, European banks had, you know, Tier 1 capital ratio of like 2%. And now they're around 12. So in order to do that, you had to do a tremendous amount of deleveraging of banks' balance sheets. And given how essential the banking system is in Europe in the intermediation process, that really shrank the economy. So the monetary liquidity injections did not reach an intended effect for the past 10 years. Now, I think that we already have experienced a shift. I mean, in the U.S., people are being paid $1,000 a week to play the PlayStation. We are seeing this $750 billion relief package in Europe that's going to be spent on unemployment benefit, on direct aid, and so forth. Now, it hasn't been inflationary yet, mostly because these things take time. I mean, the system is not set up for, you know, treasury issuance of $3 trillion in 3 months. This is where we've been in the past 3 months. Usually that takes 3 to 5 years. So it takes time for things to be spent. I mean, if you look at the general government account at the Fed, you know, 25% of the Fed balance sheet is effectively on the Fed balance sheet because the Treasury hasn't spent the money. It's issued the debt, the Fed bought it, but then the cash has come back on the balance sheet because the Treasury hasn't had time to spend money. So just give it time. Now we get this impression that, oh, we can spend and it's free and there won't be any inflation. Well, that's because the money hasn't been spent. A lot of it also has gone into money market funds, which is typical of what you typically see in a flight to safety. After a wait, we saw an increase of $1.5 trillion money market fund. Now it's more being like $2 trillion. So it's almost a crazy economy where, you know, the government issues debt to send money to people, and then the people take the money the government sends them and they buy treasury debt. So as long as that happens and we have this very high savings rate, yeah, we can keep going. There won't be any inflation. But when the economy starts to normalize, when the government actually starts to spend the money and spend it will, because that's what governments do, when the economy reopens, I mean, the savings rate is going to fall down and you'll see the velocity increase. And that's when we'll have the inflation problem. Just give it time. My estimate is that it's going to start to happen by the end of the year. And in 2021, you will already see inflation above the 2% target. At the beginning, I think the Fed will welcome that. They say, look, it's working. We're saving the economy. This is great. And then it would just keep creeping up until it becomes a problem.
Let's talk about what to do about that problem. Gold and precious metals are the obvious investment answer. Now, until very recently, it had been starting to feel almost like a blow-off top that I was really getting concerned about. We're recording this interview on Tuesday, a couple days before our listeners will hear it, and we're finally seeing the first significant down day in the gold market in months and months, down, boy, almost $100 as we're speaking on the day. Where is this headed? Is this a buy the dip moment? Should we be jumping at this? Or is the gold market maybe a little bit ahead of itself and it's better to wait for a bigger dip?
I would say both. I'm totally on board with you, that, you know, it's not healthy for, I mean, what was it, like 7 or 8 days to gold is like up. And even as a gold bull, you really don't want to see that, because that creates the risk of a dip. And it could be that we have that dip. I'm not smart enough to predict, you know, how big it's going to be, how long it's going to last. But what I know, if your investment horizon is more than a year, I think you just buy it. I mean, the case for gold remains. And in a weird way, the case for gold today is the same argument that used to be made against gold 5 years ago, work now in favor of gold. And let me explain that a little bit. I mean, one argument against gold is that, you know, it has no intrinsic value, right? You can't do a discounted cash flow analysis. It's in the eye of the beholder. And you can make that an argument for the upside as well. Like, is gold overvalued at $2,000? I don't know. No one knows. It depends on how much people want to own gold. So, you know, there's no limit to the upside or the down other than zero on the price of gold. The other argument that people make against gold is that, well, it doesn't produce any cash flow, doesn't pay a dividend, doesn't do a buyback. Well, we are going to be in a world where dividends are going to be cut. Buybacks are already being hammered everywhere. So, you know, gold is not suffering for that because there's no dividend or buyback to cut. And then finally, the usual argument is that gold doesn't produce anything, doesn't generate cash flow. Well, guess what? There's 15 trillion of bonds that have a negative yield. So, you know, gold is a high yield asset compared to government bonds at this point. Real yields are collapsing all around the world. I mean, you look at the 10-year inflation protected treasury security in the US, I mean, you're going to get negative 60 basis point yield. So over the course of if you want to hold it to maturity, you're going to lose 6% of your purchasing power if you buy kits. As long as you have that, gold is a better alternative and just can keep going.
Vincent, I know a lot of the work that you do at StoneX focuses on Latin America. Does that play into the gold story, or why is Latin America such a big part of your work?
Absolutely. And I think it's an answer to your earlier question about you are in a concern, which I think is totally valid, about, you know, gold having run up too quickly, too fast, and the risk of a blow-off top in gold. Well, what can you do if you're concerned about that, but you're still concerned about inflation, you're still concerned about the weak dollar? I think Latin America is a Latin American assets in general, and equities in particular, are a way to capitalize on that and buy an asset that is still trading at generational lows. So you don't have the froth in the market that you see in the gold market. And you have a very much same dynamic. I mean, Latin America is a weak dollar trade on crack. I mean, these are economies that borrow in dollars, so they have a massive net short dollar, and they earn revenues in inflation-sensitive assets, typically commodities. Usually that's a horrible thing to do, and that's why Latin American assets are usually a bad idea. But if you expect the dollar to go down, and if you expect to see inflation, you get it from both ends, and you get it at secular lows in terms of valuation. I mean, here's just one last stat I'm going to mention on this. Amazon as a company is worth 3 times more than the MSCI Brazil index. You know, you can make a joke about the Amazon River and Amazon the company if you want to make that fun. But anyway, the point is, one U.S. company is worth 3 times more than a continent-sized economy with amazing natural resources, with earnings. I mean, if you look at earnings over the past 10 years on an inflation-adjusted basis, Brazilian stocks have earned 10 times more than Amazon, and yet they trade for a third of the price. Of course, there's plenty of risk with Latin America, political risk, especially in Brazil, COVID risk. But if the concern is weak dollar, inflation, and you want to hedge through cheap assets, Latin American equities is where you want to go.
And finally, Vincent, we have links in our research roundup email to several sample institutional research reports, which you've recently written. Please tell our listeners what they can expect to find there. What are these reports about, and what should they expect when they open them up?
Absolutely. So there are four reports that will be made public. One is on this generational divide, which is called Not Okay Boomer, and it goes into this differentiated inflation measure between boomers and millennials and Gen Zers, and how to solve it, and how I expect it to be solved via MMT. There's another one, which is the case for inflation, just going through the six horsemen. There's another one on the nuclear winter of the 60-40 portfolio, breaking down, you know, where the decision comes from. Can the FANG really grow into the valuation? What's being baked in the market? How can we achieve it? What would happen to bond prices if yields went negative? And all these things are generally suggest that we cannot get good returns people to portfolio, by the way. And then the last one is something that I call the bull market cult is endangering the economy, which basically goes into a view that what's good for the stock market is now bad for the economy. And conversely, if we had a good economy, we'd have a bad stock market. So this is an example of the work I produced for StoneX. If people are interested, they should reach out to me on Twitter. I will put a link to a page where they can sign up for my work. The best way to get it, of course, to trade with us. We trade a lot of stuff. We have offices around the world. But even if you are not institutional level with an account that I have with StoneX, you can reach out to me and we can figure out a way to get you the research.
Vincent, I want to thank you for a terrific interview. Patrick Ceresna and I will be back as Macro Voices continues right here at macrovoices.com.
Macro Voices is a listener-driven program. Please email requests for specific future interview guests to requests@macrovoices.com. We also welcome your suggestions for how we can improve the program. Now, back to your hosts, Eric Townsend and Patrick Ceresna.
Eric, it was great to have Vincent on the show. I mean, it was really interesting, his take on the 60-40 portfolio. There's no shortage of incredibly smart people talking about what comes next after we hit the zero bound on interest rates, where bonds no longer have that hedge built into them that they typically have provided, that balanced portfolio, and what is the alternative to that. And so it was really interesting to get his take on all of that. What did you take away?
Patrick, the 60-40 portfolio has already been broken for years. If you just look at where interest rates are and look at the usual argument for why you would have bonds to balance the stocks in your portfolio and to essentially provide a buffer when the stocks go down, the bonds go up. The bonds don't have a lot of room to go up when you're already at zero interest rates. So it's already not working. The thing is, that has not caused the wholesale abandonment of that strategy by the mainstream finance community. So the question that's on my mind is the George Soros reflexivity question of, okay, what does it take to get to the point where it's not just a few crazies on Macro Voices that have been pointing these things out for the last couple of years that 60-40 doesn't really work anymore. But when do you get to the point where even the robo-advisor crowd, the mainstream finance community, recognizes that it's not working and realizes that they need to change to something else? What are they going to try to change to? And what is the result of that going to be in markets? I think that's the $64 trillion question, is what happens when the whole industry figures out that it's not working? We're probably still a few more years away from that, but that's what I've been thinking about. And frankly, I don't know the answer. What I do know is that you put together another terrific post-game chart deck. Now, listeners, what we discussed last week was with gold at all-time record highs and having moved up so quickly, we really thought that you ought to be thinking about using option strategies to protect against downside in case there was a sudden pullback in the market. Well, guess what? That was really good advice, but we told you we'd wait till this week to tell you how those strategies work. Hopefully, some of you tuned in to Big Picture Trading. Certainly, Big Picture Trading members got the full story from Patrick and had time to act on it. For everyone else, Patrick, how do we adjust course to talk about what maybe is a better fit now that we've had this correction and it's already, is it behind us completely or is it just partly behind us? I'm not sure. What do we do from here?
Well, Eric, let's start off actually just talking about gold and silver on the charts and what's happening. And then I really want to take a dive into the way that the options market on gold and silver work. And it's I find it a really amazing market to trade in. And I want to share with all of our listeners why I feel that way about it. And even though maybe the initial hedge of this correction may have been missed, there's lots of opportunities moving forward to utilizing options on gold and silver and building all sorts of really neat asymmetric trades using them. So on chart two, I've got gold. And really, what I wanted to highlight both on gold and on page three, silver, is that what we witnessed over the span of a several day market correction was a pretty much a 50% retracement of the most recent swing higher. And so this retracement fits all of the typical characteristics of a buy on dip. Usually in the normal ebb and flow of markets, you have a rise and then the rise is checked with a retracement and it's bought. Often you'll have the trailing moving averages sitting just below, which a lot of technicians will be buying the test of moving averages. And what's particularly interesting is gold has had this characteristic going back a year or two that almost all dips tend to be bought within about 5 days off the high. And, you know, some are a little bit longer, some shorter. But what I'm very curious about in the coming days is to find out whether this is a dip that was bought no different than every other past one. And if it is, it's an asymmetric moment because often the bases that come off these types of corrections reset the momentum and often put in motion a brand new up leg. And will we see that in gold and silver? One of the more interesting puzzle pieces for us to solve in the coming days. But I mean, at this stage, I think giving the benefit of the doubt, I think that this potentially was a key buying opportunity.
Well, I certainly bought more on this dip and I've got resting limit orders in place to buy even more if we get closer to 1800, which was where the breakout zone started. So I think there's an argument technically to say we could get back down there. Although just watching the tape in the last day or so, it looks like maybe this thing's already over. So, you got to buy a little on each dip and be ready to buy a little more if it dips further. Don't rule out the possibility, folks, that there could be even more downside to come.
So Eric, I wanted to move on to page four, where I have a chart courtesy of Brent over at Spot Gamma. Brent, thanks for sending this over. But what he calculated here was actually the amount of call buying that's happening on silver has put dealers being short gamma on a large amount of call options. And it's showing this chart. It's a very kind of Charlie McElligott kind of chart to look at, but specifically focusing on the SLV options. And what's interesting is that the dealers being short a whole whack of gamma, as the silver is rallying, it's actually forcing dealers to chase the market higher by having to buy the SLV and contributing to the momentum to the upside. A good example of where this was recently seen was when Tesla was ripping to the upside. All the out-of-the-money call buying on Tesla had the dealers short gamma and actually contributed to actually accelerating the upside. And now we're seeing actually a very similar characteristic on SLV. What's interesting is that that gamma really gets going all the way up to the $30 strike on the SLV, which still lies $4 or $5 higher from where we are. It'll be really interesting to see with the current structure whether or not some of that volatility gives silver another go on the upside.
Patrick, moving on to page 5, it looks to me like you've designed a ramp to ride a skateboard down to do the gamma flip as you come off the end of the jump. Maybe it's something else. Explain the chart.
All right. Well, what I wanted to really talk about is why I love trading options on gold and silver and why it's such a great market to do all sorts of hedging on. And in order to understand why there's this edge, at least in the character of the way the options markets trade on gold and silver, is to see what a typical options market skew looks like. And what you can observe here, this is the SPY for the S&P 500. You have what's known as the fat left tail, which is as you move to the left side of this chart, the implied volatilities are higher and higher on out of the money puts. And that's typical because the stock market tends to have that nature of that old saying of it rises on an escalator and drops on an elevator. You always have to have a price in a higher implied on the downside risks within the market. And typically, because of this, what it means is that building a zero-cost collar or some other way of hedging risk doesn't allow you the opportunity to do it near zero cost. Often you're collecting a very small call premium for income, and you have a very expensive put to buy as insurance, and it doesn't give you the ability to build asymmetric payoffs. And even though people do it because of the nature of the market, this is just the way that the typical skew looks for majority of stocks. But if we go to page 6 and 7, you can see the skews on both SLV and GLD for gold and silver. What you can observe is that the characteristic is actually the opposite, where what you have is that the implied volatilities on call options are actually higher as you're going out of the money. And as you go out of the money on puts, the hedging is actually relatively cheaper as measured by the implied volatility priced into these options. And this now gives you a whole array of amazing option strategies that you can implement, particularly to silver and gold, that you don't have the same opportunities to get the same kind of payoff profiles as you would in the traditional market. Now, one of the strategies that I've been doing quite actively, and the one we talked about last week, is the idea of building a collar, which is the idea of buying a protective put and then using an out-of-the-money call to covered call to pay for it, and being able to do so at a zero cost and have your ability to hedge wrap your risk in there. But what is also really neat about a market that trades this way with their skews is that if you are bullish and you're looking for upside, you can really get some compelling payoff profiles on just very traditional debit spreads or other vertical or even diagonal spreads that you can put on the upside, just because those really far out of the money calls are still paying very robust call premiums, giving all sorts of really amazing option strategies you can build upon it. And so I wanted to share some of these. Obviously, with the gold correction underway, it didn't make a whole lot of sense explaining an existing SLV collar. But what I wanted to do was just share with our listeners, anyone who wants to take a dive into the live markets and see what these kind of trade setups look like. I was going to be doing on Monday, on August 17th, a special live webinar for all of my free trialers and members at Big Picture Trading, where we're going to go into that live market and actually look at these options chains and build all sorts of these really neat different option strategies around gold and silver, taking advantage of these skews.
And that's coming up this Monday, August 17th, 1 to 2 p.m. Eastern Time. You've got to sign up at Big Picture Trading either for a free trial or be a member at Big Picture Trading in order to participate. Now, if you're not available Monday exactly between 1 and 2 p.m., is it possible to watch it after the fact as a replay?
For sure. The recording is going to be available on the website almost immediately after we do it live. So everyone that wanted to watch it will be able to get access to it. But it's in the live session, I have the opportunity to interact real time with them. And so questions and other that members have, they can throw them at me, and I'm take my very best stab at answering all of the really interesting particulars about using options in gold and silver. But just to give a very quick sample, right now, if you let's say went out on SLV. So let's just say that gamma skew that we talked about on chart four stayed true, and there was an opportunity for silver to be bought on dip, and maybe we see an impulse higher that can see us moving toward, let's say, $30 on the upside. Well, right now, if you go out 36 days on a September 18th expiry, doing a, let's say, $26 to a $30 bull call spread out for 36 days, giving you a $4 upside spread, you can pretty much open it very close to a dollar. And so you could get a 4-to-1 payoff profile like this for continuing to kind of play the bet that the upside on silver is there and still have a very defined and limited risk if it doesn't materialize. It's just an example of some of the really neat things you can do in that gold and silver market.
And listeners, of course, you can sign up for a free 14-day trial of Big Picture Trading at bigpicturetrading.com. We're going to leave it there for this week. This episode was made possible by toptradersunplugged.com. Remember to get the ultimate guide to the best investing books ever written at toptradersunplugged.com/macro guide. For information on sponsoring Macro Voices, please visit macrovoices.com/sponsor info. Listeners, be sure to register a free account at macrovoices.com. The benefit to you is you'll receive our Research Roundup email, which provides you with all of the best free content that we could find on the internet each week, including downloads associated with our guest appearances, as well as, of course, our post-game chart books. Patrick, tell them what they can expect to find in this week's Research Roundup.
Well, this week you're going to find the transcript for today's interview, as well as a link to Vincent's slides and the chart deck we just discussed in the post game. There's also a link to an interesting article titled "Nothing is Rock Solid, Even Yellow Metal," and a link to the Jeffrey Snyder article "Inflation Hysteria 2, Because Reasons." And so you'll find this and so much more in this week's Research Roundup. So that does it for this week's episode. We appreciate all the feedback and support we get from our listeners, and we're always looking for suggestions on how we can make the program even better. Now, for those of our listeners that write or blog about the markets and would like to share that content with our listeners, send us an email at researchroundup@macrovoices.com or tag it with the MVRR hashtag on Twitter, and we'll consider it for our weekly distributions. If you have not already, follow our main Twitter account at Macro Voices for all the most recent updates and releases. You can also follow Eric on Twitter at Eric S. Townsend and myself at Patrick Sresna. On behalf of Eric Townsend and myself, thank you for listening, and we'll see you all next week.
That concludes this edition of Macro Voices. Be sure to tune in each week to hear feature interviews with the brightest minds in finance and macroeconomics. Macro Voices is made possible by sponsorship from BigPictureTrading.com, the Internet's premier source of online education for traders. Please visit BigPictureTrading.com for more information. Please register your free account at MacroVoices.com. Once registered, you'll receive our free weekly Research Roundup email containing links to supporting documents from our featured guests and the very best free financial content our volunteer research team could find on the internet each week. You'll also gain access to our free listener discussion forums and research library. And the more registered users we have, the more we'll be able to recruit high-profile feature interview guests for future programs. So please register your free account today at macrovoices.com if you haven't already.
You can subscribe to Macro Voices on iTunes to have Macro Voices automatically delivered to your mobile device each week, free of charge. You can email questions for the program to mailbag@macrovoices.com, and we'll answer your questions on the air from time to time in our mailbag segment. Macro Voices is presented for informational and entertainment purposes only. The information presented on Macro Voices should not be construed as investment advice. Always consult a licensed investment professional before making investment decisions. The views and opinions expressed on Macro Voices are those of the participants and do not necessarily reflect those of the show's hosts or sponsors. Macro Voices, its producers, sponsors, and hosts Eric Townsend and Patrick Ceresna shall not be liable for losses resulting from investment decisions based on information or viewpoints presented on Macro Voices. Macro Voices is made possible by sponsorship from BigPictureTrading.com and by funding from Fourth Turning Capital Management, LLC. For more information, visit MacroVoices.com.